Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. What's behind the recent deadly clashes between communities on the border of Ethiopia and Kenya?
In the wake of this incident, the local communities seized 32 Kenyan fishermen and then also 5 boats. So after that, they released the fishermen, but they kept the boats because there had been these contests over boats and then other fishing gear.
Also, why African communities in Germany are concerned after a far-right political party came second in the recent elections. And persons living with disabilities in Somalia hopeful after a bill is passed to protect their rights.
In terms of the main provisions for this law, it promises to be a game changer for disabled community in Somalia. The law also provides for inclusive representation and also guarantees political representation for persons with disabilities.
It's Wednesday, February 26th. First, to matters concerning Kenya and Ethiopia. The two countries share a long and porous border stretching over 860 kilometers. It traverses Marsabit, Turkana, Wajir and Mandera counties on the Kenyan side and Borana and Dawa regions on the Ethiopian side. The area is remote and little investment in the way of education, security and healthcare has happened from either Nairobi or Addis Ababa. Often, communities living along either side of the border cross over in search for water and pasture for their livestock. And whenever this happens, there's always a risk of conflict over resources. The latest clash at the weekend left over 13 Ethiopians dead and 22 Kenyans missing when a fight erupted between groups of armed pastoralists and fishermen. Those affected were from Ethiopia's Dasenech district and Kenya's Turkana county. Around 10,000 people have fled their homes in Dasenech for fear of further violence. I've been speaking with the BBC's Eastern Africa correspondent, Kalkidan Yibeltal, in Ethiopia.
What we understood is this is not the first incident. Even in recent weeks, there had been tit-for-tats and clashes and, you know, retaliatory attacks. And despite calls and then discussions by local authorities, what has happened is that the violence is resurfacing.
It's not the first time that these clashes are happening. But how far back do this go? Do the communities in this region have a history of tensions and violence towards and against each other?
The clashes or violent confrontations or disagreements and tensions seem to revolve primarily around resources. Because, you know, Ethiopia shares a long border with Kenya and, you know, vice versa. But there are other parts of the border that have other problems, for example, political instability. In other parts of that border, there is a movement of armed groups, there is a movement of insurgent groups, there is a recently growing recurrence of kidnapping for ransom. The armed group, the Oromo Liberation Army, also moves around those other parts of the border. But in this particular area, the clashes and the tensions seem to be primarily and mainly around resources.
According to authorities, it's armed men that were involved in this incident. Who are these armed individuals? Do the authorities have a good idea of who they are?
They have not, you know, specified who they are, or it doesn't seem that there is this well-organized and well-armed militia. It doesn't seem that way, but most of the pastoralists in those areas are armed. They move around with their cattle and they are mostly armed. So what happens often is that whenever there is an incident, whenever one community member is attacked or killed or somehow, you know, assaulted, the men in these communities are gathered, they pick up their arms and then they cross borders and then launch attacks. But more detailed pictures are yet to emerge, and we are going to find out how the incident happened and who these people are and if there is any accountability to be had.
And usually, how well policed is this area along the border of Kenya and Ethiopia?
It doesn't seem it's very well policed, and That is shown by how recurrent and how frequent these incidents are. Even the local officials, they admit that they have tried on several incidents to have discussions with their counterparts in Kenya, and there had been promises and pledges of increasing security forces, but it doesn't seem that has happened. And one thing that we must understand is these bordering areas are not small. This is a very large chunk of area, and it's going to require a huge number of, you know, police force or security force to properly police it.
So this latest attack happened because of disagreement on fishing activities. Just how significant is this location for fishing?
It's very significant. These communities are dependent either on their cattle, on fishing. That's how they feed themselves and their families. That's how they make their living. So fishing is a very integral part of their way of life. It's a very integral part of their economy. And because of that, there had been disagreements and then contestations over fishing territories, over fishing equipment. Even now, the authorities on the Ethiopian side were telling us that in the wake of this incident, the local communities seized 32 Kenyan fishermen and then also 5 boats. So after that, they released the fishermen, but they kept the boats because there had been these contests over boats and other fishing gear.
Give us a sense of how local leaders and authorities from both Kenya and Ethiopia are responding to this latest incident.
The Kenyan authorities said that after this incident was reported, that the local Kenyan authorities, they have dispatched security forces there. They have spoken to the survivors and tried to understand and, you know, have a sense of what exactly happened and how can this be prevented in the future. On the Ethiopian side, the local officials were telling us that even last week they were having conversations with their Kenyan counterparts on preventing incidents like this. When, especially after the first incident in a series of incidents happened, they were having conversations with their Kenyan counterparts and they intend to continue doing that in the future as well.
Is there a risk, Alkidan, of this spiraling out of control and becoming a larger regional crisis? Because you said that the border between these two countries is long and it's porous, and you have different actors, some with political motives, others with ethnic motives, you know, playing their parts.
Ethiopian border is now seeing, you know, an unusual increase in incidents now, because Ethiopia borders with several other countries, with Sudan, with Somalia, with Eritrea, with Djibouti, and so forth. And other borders had this, you know, political instabilities over the years and over the decades. However, particularly in recent years, the Kenyan border seemed to be more or less stable. Now, in the past weeks and in the past months, in recent months, we are seeing, you know, a resurgence of these incidents. I don't see this particular incident, you know, growing into a more regional conflict, because, as I said, it's just, you know, particularly restricted and limited to that community. Members of those communities are very much impacted by what has transpired and their lives are uprooted, and some of them have lost family members. So it's a huge tragedy for the communities living there. But I don't see it growing into a huge regional conflict impacting the wider Kenyan and Ethiopian border.
Kalkidan Yebeltal, BBC Eastern Africa correspondent, speaking from Ethiopia. To Germany now. This is the moment the Conservative Christian Democratic Union, CDU, and its sister party, the Christian Social Union, CSU, collectively known as the CDU-CSU party, won the recent German elections. The result spelled a defeat for the ruling Social Democratic Party, SDP, led by Olaf Scholz, who has been Germany's chancellor since 2021. But perhaps the detail that caught the attention of many is the rise of the far-right Alternative for Germany, AfD party, which was voted for by 1 in 5 voters and came second in the elections. Before we dig into that, it's worth telling you that none of the main parties in the election got the required 316 seats in the German parliament in order to form government. So, the formation of a coalition is imminent. Back to the AfD party. Many say its success in the elections represents a shift in the political landscape in Germany.
The party is particularly well known for its stand against mass immigration at a time when concerns of racial profiling, discrimination, and social exclusion are on the rise. Now, the African diaspora in Germany fear that the rise of far-right politics is making things worse. To give us some context, I called on Joshua Kwesi Akins, a political scientist and member of the advisory board for the Initiative of Black People in Germany. We spoke about the election results, but first, let's hear what it was like for him to grow up in Germany as a black African child.
Growing up as a black person in Berlin was an experience that really showed me from an early age that ideas from the colonial times are still, unfortunately, quite alive in some segments of the population here. So there was quite a bit of anti-black racism. There was, of course, also this kind of, you know, exoticization, you know, where you have strangers, you know, touch your hair, but where you also have a demeaning and racist comments about yourself, your body, and your family. To be fair, there were, of course, also people who were resisting that, you know, who were trying to say that this is not okay. And we've come quite a long way since then, at least in terms of what is permissible to say in public. So there has been a change, but I do have to say that from the way public space is organized, you know, we still have street names here commemorating colonial aggressors, all the way to Africa being portrayed in school books and in media. There is unfortunately still a long way to go. And what we're seeing now in recent years is that the overall mood is changing again. And some of these very things that I experienced as a child, some of these normalized racist utterances that were kind of pushed back against are now unfortunately being normalized again more and more. So we have a kind of harshening of the tone. We have things becoming permissible again to say in terms of public racism. But yeah, we can feel the tone shifting, and this ranges from the way things are discussed in the media all the way to everyday racism, and unfortunately also incidents of attacks that are also on the rise.
Now, let's look at how black people in Germany are reacting to the election results. Here is Joshua again.
Well, I think the real issue in this election result is the fact that the far-right AfD party came in second with over 20% of the vote. And that is both shocking and unfortunately it was expected. So what we're seeing is that the far-right is driving some of the key debates in this country, especially around migration, which is then framed as a security issue, framed with racist tropes, and clearly where a party that is, you know, judged to be in part extreme right-wing, even by German intelligence agencies. And that is what is concerning people of African descent in this country, that while, you know, there had been debates in recent years, there had been pushback, we now feel that this issue is coming not just from the streets, but also from politics, both at the state and unfortunately now also increasingly at the federal level. The AfD has doubled its share of the vote and will have a much bigger contingent in parliament and will keep pushing this agenda. And the problem is that some of the other parties, in an attempt to garner votes, have tried to pick up on some of these problematic anti-migration and sometimes outright racist tropes. And so this has greatly contributed to this swing to the right. And that is really concerning people of African descent in our everyday life and in the way we experience politics in this country.
So tell us more about this AfD party, the Alternative for Germany, and why it's become so popular to the point that it's garnered over 20% of the vote.
Well, the AfD is a party that is on the books as having outright far-right neo-Nazi elements for a number of years. And they are actually playing far-right playbook that we have seen in other European countries and literally actually across the West. But of course, this is a particular place. This is Germany, after all, where we literally had Nazi rule. And so what is happening here is that they can lean on some of these embedded racist tropes. They can capitalize on increasing unhappiness with the dire economic situation, or at least worsening economic situation. They offer climate denialism. They actually offer this idea that, you know, you can dial the clock back to an imagined Germany of past glories, that you don't have to reflect critically on issues such as National Socialism or even colonialism. So they offer an easy way out, and they feed on, and they also stoke resentment across the country. And unfortunately, the vote share is quite young, which is also quite concerning, where you look at older generations actually voting for the AfD in much lesser numbers than younger ones. You also have a regional split where you find that the eastern part of the country is voting for them in larger numbers. And there we have, you know, an issue of, that is still a shadow of so-called reunification, where the former east of the country feels that they are still not up to par with the old Western Germany when it comes to the many issues.
Joshua, are there any similarities in ideology that you see between the AfD and the CDU party?
Well, the CDU party would, of course, say that they are conservatives and that they stand against the far right, that many of these ideas are antithetical to them. Problem is that from just a few weeks back, the likely future chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has put up a vote in parliament, in the federal parliament, where he had previously vowed to make sure that no vote is tabled that can only pass with the votes of the AfD. And he unfortunately broke that promise on the issue of migration. And so this is a very recent experience that sent shockwaves through the country. There were literally hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets to protest this. Some people actually resigned from the CDU party after that. So this was a very recent event that has stoked further worries and has also influenced the vote now, where then the CDU lost a few points and other parties to the left gained further points. So this is the current situation. So while I wouldn't say that they are ideologically the same, there is this kind of drift that I also tried to describe earlier, and that is the cause for concern. Now, when it comes to the coalition negotiations that will have to be underway as of now, people will have to closely monitor the rhetoric and also the policy issues that are tabled. Because as you said, the SPD is, former Chancellor's party, the left of center party, that has also said that they will not, you know, allow this rightward drift to happen, while they themselves also in the election cycle have been singing some of the, you know, problematic, rather anti-immigrant tunes. And so this is what is of concern now, and this is what the African and Afro-diasporic community is watching closely.
Joshua Kwesi Akins, member of the advisory board of the Initiative of Black People in Germany. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. For years, people living with disabilities in Somalia have been excluded from society, facing discrimination, isolation, and limited access to basic rights. They represent about 11% of the country's adult population, many due to the decades of civil war and terrorist attacks. Finding jobs, getting an education, or having a voice in politics has been extremely difficult. But for the first time, Somalia has passed a disability rights bill. It's been touted as a major step forward, but will it make a real difference? The BBC's Faradosa Hanshi has just returned from Mogadishu after talking to persons with disabilities. She starts our conversation by outlining the key provisions of this new law.
In terms of the main provisions for this law, it promises to be a game changer for disabled community in Somalia. The law also provides for inclusive representation and also guarantees political representation for persons with disabilities. It guarantees also and ensures accessibility to public spaces, transformation, and services requiring building roads that are accessible to people with disabilities, also transport systems that are accommodative to them. So also the public sectors will be also having now to accommodate them, getting them employment for them. And the law is also now giving a chance to criminalize discrimination against people with disabilities, which are ensuring also the employers also are being prohibited from discriminating these individuals and ensuring them they have equal opportunities for employment.
I mean, it's interesting learning that those things were not being looked at and they were not part of a law to begin with. But can you tell us how this law then compares to other disability rights protections in other countries in the region?
Everything has a start. For this country, you can see the country that has faced the political instability, conflicts and challenges. And in terms of comparing this with the neighboring countries, for example, in Kenya, people with disabilities in Kenya had a law that's going to protect them and give them representation, equal treatment and protection for the last 20 years, comparing to Somalia, which recently passed a law that's going to protect their people with disabilities. So I think it's a start, but with this something new, I think it will come with a lot of change.
Yeah, it's definitely a start. So you went to Somalia and you followed some people that live with disabilities. Can you tell us their experiences, how life is like for them and some of the challenges that they face?
Yes, I was in Somalia, I think 2 weeks ago. I have met people with disabilities who have shared with me their struggle. And growing up in a country that there was a political instability, with also communities that are facing stigma and discrimination within the community that they are living with. One of them was Fatuma, who was a gender-based violence survivor. Fatuma shared with me that she had faced a very abusive and relationship when she met with her husband and she got married to him. Both of them were in love. They got married. They started living with their husband's family. And when they started living, the family of the husband actually discriminated her because of her disability and take her husband from the room and say, you're not going to share a bed with my son because you might pass your disability to him. And this is Fatima.
When I got married, we moved in with my husband's family. His mother used to come to our room every night and take her son to another room, saying that I would transfer my disability to him. They forced us to divorce. When I gave birth to his child, they came to check whether the child was disabled like me.
That's a story of Fatma, which has been voiced by one of our colleagues here in Nairobi, and also we've changed her name to protect her identity. Are there people pushing for change in terms of how laws or how a bill like this can really start to change lives for people like Fatma and that really horrible story that we've heard about?
There's people who are pushing now to get this law to be implemented and are right from the start who have fought for this law to be actually considered and to be taken to the parliament and to be signed by the president last year, December. One of that person who fought for the law is Mohamed Dirie. I have talked to him and he told me what made him decide to fight for a law that's going to protect persons with disabilities and the challenge he faced throughout the time that he was fighting for the National Disability Protection Act.
I don't think that I'm included in my community. I have not respected my dignity. It will give us an opportunity to overcome the challenges, specifically to have a political representation, to reduce unemployment.
That was Mohamed Dirie. When I was talking to him, one of the issues that he raised to me is the struggle that now he is going to face when implementation process is on board.
So this bill has been looked at as a big step forward, but what are some of the biggest challenges in actually implementing it?
One of the challenges mostly people I talk to were actually saying is the implementation and how this bill is going to be implemented immediately. And with now elections coming next year, Somalia, and this bill now giving them representation for political positions, they were saying now with everything that's going on, how is the government now give priority to the law? In terms of the implementation process, they were telling me the trust that they have is very thin. They're saying the government might prioritize other challenges now they have. And giving priority to this law might take time, but they're hopeful it's a start for a new change. And now they at least have a law that's behind them to fight for their rights.
In terms of the government officials then, how are they also responding to this?
The government officials I spoke to told me they are going to consider and take to the government and the parliament. Also, they're going to go back to the president and other government officials to prioritize this law, and starting from next year elections, that they're going to have representation in political positions, and also ensuring government institutions hire the recommended 5% to the workforce of people with disabilities. And one of the people I spoke to is Mohamed Jama, who is the National Disability Agency in Somalia.
I think Somalia's culture is one of the discriminatory cultures in the world. So when it comes to implementing such a law, it's not easy.
You said your organization is responsible for the implementation process. How are you ensuring people with disabilities in Somalia that it's going to be, and as soon as possible it will be implemented? Because it's still hard now.
Yes, there are three articles in the law that has more urgency. And the first one is the political representation of persons with disabilities. I have an election next year. So in order to people with disabilities to participate that election, this article must be implemented immediately.
And that's Mohamed Abdul Jama, who is the chairman of the National Disability Agency in Somalia. So tell us, Fardosa, in terms of people that are listening outside of Somalia who may not understand the challenges that the country has been through, and now there's this bill that is very promising for the country. How does this all send a message to the rest of the world?
I think the rest of the world will be looking at this as a progress to a community and a society that has a very conservative and marginalization towards people with disabilities. Somalia is one of the countries that you can see people with disabilities are being nicknamed because you have a disability. Like someone who has a blind, they will call him a blind person, and it will be named by that. So I think it's a progress towards inclusion, and can push them to even have a chance to fight for their rights.
BBC journalist Fardosa Hanshi. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Twagiramaria, Amy Leibovitz, and Bella Hassan in London. Blessing Aderoba was in Lagos. The senior producer was Paul Bachibinga, and the technical producer was Chris Kuzaris. Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. With millions of people in Sudan facing hunger and possible famine due to the war between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces militia, which has been ongoing for almost 2 years, the latest edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily, asks, can Sudan feed itself in the future? I'm Charles Gitonga. Thanks for listening.